Blog Talk Radio.
And greetings, my hope to everyone. Welcome to another edition of New Day Resurrection and Liberation. My name is Empress Tree, and of course, we are coming to you live at a living color. And by the way, we are also on the road. Yep, we're coming in from the DC area. And of course, today we put on record that we are demanding a meeting with President Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris. And again, this was a teachable moment that enabled us to do kind of a reenactment, for lack of a better word, in regards to the 70-year action that took place in 1951, roughly 130 or so Black women came together with Washington, D.C. They were known as the Sojourners for Truth and Justice. And with that said, they certainly made a very clear position and a demand. They demanded to meet with the President of the United States at the time. And of course, that was Harry S. Truman. Well, we figured if our sisters could do that 70 years ago, and show a sense of unity, show a sense of collective concern, because one of the primary issues at that time was, of course, to focus on the multiplied rates of our women and girls, particularly Black males, and, of course, there's little to nothing said or done about it. Also, they raised the issue of the violence of abuse, the human rights violations of the night, that would be inflicted upon our people in general. You have to remember, 1951, a lot going on. It was right at the beginning of what's called the civil rights movement. So again, hold on. But these Black women, from very different backgrounds, professions, and so forth, came together and again made a very clear statement that white supremacy and its programming and its practices had to be dealt with, had to be gotten rid of. So again, we're raising the question in 2021. What is it that Black women are talking about doing collectively? And when I say collectively, I'm talking about on a national level. Of course, many of our women are doing wonderful things in our communities. But to what extent is that really connected to the bigger picture? And in this day and age, certainly, if it's not, well, it's kind of continuing the same old thing. And you know what has been said about that. If you continue to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result, well, you know what they say about that. And we can see it right before our eyes because very little is changing. Well, the better that is. Much is changing for the person. No schools, and when I say no schools, for the most part, no independent school. No cultural center. And again, for the most part, that is independent. Nothing that really represents what we need to do in our community. Health facilities, where they at? Where are the kinds of things that the community really has to maintain? We are good at going to a few events, going to a conference, going to a festival. But what about the things that we're really question? We answer that. We know the answer. Just to say, we have responsibility for ourselves. So now we're going to begin putting that process. And so tonight, we're going to talk with someone that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and for those who aren't, well, you should be. We have to look at those who make serious contributions to the liberation of our people. And that said, then you have to talk with your brother. And again, this brother is truly, truly a poet and a author, a filmmaker, but probably someone who has been on the front lines in fighting for our people. And I'm talking about none other than our brother, Kalamu Ya Salam. We're going to be talking with him very shortly. And again, family, before we do, we're going to bring to your attention some of what we were able to do today. And again, it was just a kickoff start, because what we're now going to do is travel into various cities, organizing our women, those who want to be involved, and begin to really map out what do we want to talk to Biden and Vice President Harris. What do we want to talk about? What are some of the things that we want to make clear that we want some answers for? And again, given the fact that they both said that black women played a pivotal role in them being elected, we must now say, what you going to do for us? What are you going to do for our people? And to do that, we have to be well organized and ready, because we can't just move forward and ask for a meeting. We have to do so in a way that is going to represent the real best interests of our people. And so we're going to take our time, and we're going to go to various cities, and we're going to hear what are the top seven issues, let's say 5 to 7. And then we'll draw from that, and then we will prepare. And again, we'll be sending out letters to various black women in various cities, their opinions, to get their thoughts, but also to get their support for this meeting with President Biden and Vice President Harris. Two separate meetings, by the way. We don't want them there at the same time. And I can tell you right now that one of the questions is going to be around the issue of reparatory justice. Now, we know what they said publicly, and you do know that sometimes people say things publicly and then they say something else privately. And we're smart enough to know how to do that, if that's the way it has to go, as long as it's productive, as long as there is success. And so we're going to see, but we also have to be ready to make sure that if our response is not what we think it should be, we have to then be prepared to take further actions. So with that said, I'm going to see now who is really who, as I've been saying for the past 4 years in particular. Going to see who's who and what is really what. It was just like, you know, in that we talk about liberation, talk about self-determination, we talk about justice, but where's the plan of action? And then when you hear a plan of action, how are you really evaluating it? How are you really attempting to comprehend it? Or is it kind of more easily to bash. At any rate, we don't hear if that is the case. We're going to make sure that we move forward. With that said, we're going to get ready to reach out to our brother. And for those, again, who are not familiar with him, if you Google him, certainly you will come up with quite a few very, very interesting, not just articles, but interviews. And again, you know, years of teaching, years of work, years of writing. We're going to talk to Brother, who, by the way, is, I hope you don't mind me telling his age, he's 74. So he's been around for a while. He's based in New Orleans. And again, you know, a former member of SNCC, involved in, you know, quite a few very active things that many of us have heard about and talked about. okay? And so what we're going to do now is, again, Cindy, as I've said earlier, we are literally on the road coming back from the D.C. area. Oh, speaking of the D.C. area, before we bring in my brother, I want to convey to everyone that on October 11th, we will be doing a special kickoff for this month, your Territory Justice Virtual Conference, and this will be a tribute, a salute to our brother, Ken Bridges. Ken Bridges, of course, was murdered in 2002 on October the 11th, allegedly or supposedly by the so-called D.C. sniper. Well, we're going to hear with his family, but talk also about the work of Ken Bridges, his contribution, his vision in creating and being the co-founder of the Mata Network. We're going to talk about that and other things relevant to Ken Bridges and why his work was so important and why we must strive to continue that work. And so we're going to talk about what he called internal reparations. Again, that'll be October the 11th, and we will be kicking off this month's Repairing Through Justice Conference with that tribute to Ken Bridges. And by the way, joining us for that tribute, for those who are familiar with Blackonomics, well, we'll be talking to Brother Jim Blakeman, who will be joining us. We're also expecting to talk to Brother Phillips and several others who were involved in the Mata Network, not only in Philadelphia Tri-State Area, but also in other locations. Okay, let's do this. We're going to get ready to bring in our brother, Palama Yasalam. And can we all get ready? Because this right here is definitely a winner. This is going to be a conversation that I think we're going to enjoy. We're going to get a lot out of it. You talk about knowledgeable. Well, certainly he is that. So let's see. We can. Let me see what's going on here. I'm not seeing my regular call in piece. Give me one moment. Something is not happening here. Oops. We have a little problem. So. Okay. Give me a moment, and I have to find where the. Oh, I see it. Okay. All right. Here we go. Okay. All right. We're going to call him now. So just bear with me a moment. Okay. There we go. All right. Connecting with you in a few moments, I hope. Let's see. Oh, something is not on. Let's try again. There we are. Uh-oh. Let me see. Let me hold on for one more. I'm going to try again. Maybe I put it in wrong. So, let's see. Oh, yeah, I did. I see it. Okay. All right, let me try that again. Let's see. Okay. Hopefully this will do it. Oh, it's doing it. still having a few technical problems, so let's try one more time. Okay. All right. Okay, I think we finally got it. Okay, Shannon, what is going on right now physically, because we're going through an area that I think might not allow us to, we don't want to understand okay, we're having some problems connecting, so just give us a minute, we're going to still try to do that. And again, it's primarily because we're on the road and are in an area that is restricting the call to this grid. So as soon as we're out of this area, we should be able to, we're just kind of like idle. Okay, in the meantime, while we're waiting for the vehicle to go through this area, we want to make sure that we give a big shout out to our brother Bob Brown. Bob Brown was with us today and shared a lot of wonderful information. And so we thank him again for his participation and also his support. We're going to have to stop. And so this is really with us. And let's see, we should be able to do so now, I think. Okay, I'm showing the number. The number's there, so is it right there? So I'm trying to figure out. Okay, all right. My brother, if you can hear me, I need you to hang up, and we're going to try calling you again, because I'm seeing the number there, but we're not able to hear you. So we need you to hang up, and we're going to try to call you back again, and hopefully we should be able to get through it. Okay, so. Okay. All right, family, we're trying one more time. Okay, I'm still not hearing the dial tone on that end, so that means it's not going through. Okay. All right, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to try another way to do this. So let's try this. And family, we apologize again for the delay and the inconvenience. Can you call this number and ask him to call number? So, see if you can get through. See if you can get through on that number. And then ask if he can call this number. Okay, we're going to try another route, family, because for whatever reason, we're trying to connect with him from the board, and it's not going through. So we're going to ask him to see if he can connect to us. And hopefully that will allow us to have the dialogue with him. All right, in the meantime, for those who, again, do not know of this brother's work, we're going to kind of give you a little bit of insight into some of his profound poetry. And also, he is a music critic, so he does some very critical analysis when it comes to music. And we really want to you know, make certain that you're able to give him the time to be able to share the information with you. And so let's see what we're able to do. And again, hopefully we can get through to him in a few minutes. In the meantime, while we're waiting to do that connection, I want everyone to know that starting, actually, again, we said in this month, we're going to start sessions that will enable us to get organized in our sisters nationwide. If you're in Philly next week, then you can join us for one of our first sessions that focuses on the violence and abuse of our women and girls and what we're going to do about attempting to, you know, not attempting to, but making certain that we are able to change that situation. Also, and that is going to be on Saturday, October the 9th, I believe it is, yeah. October the 9th, next Saturday, we'll be at City Hall, and we will be gathering at 3 o'clock at City Hall, and we will begin to organize in terms of addressing some of the issues here in Philadelphia first, because this is where we're at. And, of course, we'll be connecting with sisters in other cities as it pertains to some of the same issues that we're talking about, you know, for this entire month and then, of course, for the rest of the year. But for those that don't know, National Violence and Abuse Month. That's what many are observing for this month. And actually, it's National Domestic Violence and Abuse Month. Well, needless to say, domestic for us does not just mean, you know, in your house. Domestic means in a kind of landscape or in a kind of cornet where we're talking about on a national level. When you travel, needless to say, you see that there's two lanes. One is domestic and one is international. Well, we're talking about domestic in the context of this entire land. There are things that are happening in this entire land that now has to be addressed when it comes to our women and girls. Again, we're talking about sex trafficking. We're talking about kidnapping. Certainly murders. And by the way, we will be talking very soon with Breonna Taylor. One of Breonna Taylor's house, I believe it is, will be joining us for one of our programs in the very near future. There's a lot going on with that particular case, as well as with the other cases that you're not really hearing a lot about right now. But certainly, it's not, again, happening as it pertains to the violence and abuse of our women and girls. And again, we are very concerned with the fact that Black women are not speaking out, is not standing out in the way that we. While we're waiting for our brother to call in, we want to send our condolences out to our sister, Angela. Those of you who are familiar with our program know that Sister Angela was one of our very powerful, oops, I don't know.
Again, what I was saying prior
to the call coming in. We send our condolences out to Sister Angela Sales, again, who was one of our very serious and powerful coordinators for MWM20. Her father may transition this week, and they were very, very close. And so, of course, the family is definitely at this time, feeling the loss. And so, again, we condolences and our love out to her family. And we also forgot to mention a few weeks back, we may have mentioned it, but certainly not to the degree that we should have, and that is Brother Darrell Williams. He, too, also made transition a few weeks ago, and he was one of our brothers in support, one of our brothers in support of the Million Women March, and he represented the Cleveland area. He was very instrumental in helping us to get things done in 2017, and he also made transition, and again, he was very close to Sister Angela. In fact, that is how he came into the MWM movement, was through Sister Angela. Okay, let's see. We're looking for our brother to call in. Brother Kalamu, if you can hear me, I'm not seeing your number, but if you do hear me, you can press 1 so that I can identify that it is you, and then we can continue to... Oh, there we are. Okay, very good. All right, family. So, again, we thank all of you for being patient. You know how technology can be sometimes. And, unfortunately, this was one of those times. And it's probably because the conversation is going to be so powerful and so and just enlightening and insightful. Because, a lot of times when we do these really, really energetic and just poignant kinds of programs, it just seems that every now and then when that happens, we end up with some difficulties. But we have him now, and it is certainly a pleasure and an honor to have this brother on our program. We hope that this will be the first of many times, particularly now as we move forward in not only bringing forward the Million Women March Universal Movement, but in that some of the arts and culture component, some of the, I dare say, literary areas. And so we're getting prepared to introduce the National Black Women's Writers Guild. Again, we want to introduce to you, our family, some of the people that we've been able to build with and look to build with in the future. And certainly the brother that we're getting ready to bring you now is one of those brothers, because again, for us, it's not just about talent. It's not just about skill. It's not just about the quality work that, of course, many of our people have, but it's also about commitment. It's also about dedication and definitely the ideals of liberation. So without further ado, family, I want to introduce to you our brother, Kalamu Yasalam, is in the house. Greetings to you, my brother.
Greetings. How are you doing? Hopefully everyone is doing well out there.
Absolutely. Well, we better now because we have you with us. All right. I almost don't know where to begin, but I'm going to begin again by welcoming you to the segment of your day. And also welcoming you to the family of the New Day Extended Family. I'm just going to kind of give the mic to you and start with just sharing with our family a little bit about you. Who is Kalamu Yasalam?
Well, Kalamu Yasalam is a writer and activist. I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, 24th of March, 1947. My mother was a school teacher, and my father was a laboratory technician. He served in World War II and the Korean conflict. And when he came out of the Army, mm-hmm. he applied for a job at the Veterans Administration Hospital, which was located on the lakefront Pontchartrain Lake in New Orleans at that time. It has since moved two times. But at that time, it was located on the lakefront. And when he applied for a position, they declined to hire him.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote letters protesting that he was a veteran and he was eligible for the position at the Veterans Hospital. Long story short, after a number of attempts, one of his letters finally ended up in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
The National Office of the Veterans Administration wrote back to the New Orleans local office and told them that they had to hire him because he was a veteran and he was qualified. Not only as a veteran qualifying for a position with the government, but also when he was in the Army, he was specifically trained as a laboratory technician. So he was hired, but he had to fight it in order to be hired. And my mother, who was a school teacher, and this was a number of years later, by that time, I'm born and my two brothers are born. And she's very active in the union of the at that period in New Orleans. And on one of the instances, she was the only teacher at her school who walked the picket line, even though two of her sisters, one was a secretary and the other was a sixth grade teacher. Two of her sisters also were at that same school, but they did not walk the picket line. They supported the strike, but they didn't walk the picket line. She walked the picket line. My mother's name was Inola Copeland Ferdinand, and my father was Valerie Ferdinand Jr. And that's my beginning. That's where I began.
Wow. All right. All right. So certainly those experiences really lent to some of the development or some of the other kinds of interactions that you had when it comes to dealing with what people now call social justice issues.
Yes, that's, well, my whole upbringing in the movement, I didn't fully realize it at the time, but that's what was happening. In fact, when my father came out of the Army, he used the GI Bill and his savings to buy a house in the lower Ninth Ward area of New Orleans. And the house we grew up in, myself and my two brothers, was located at the extreme edge of the lower Ninth Ward at that period. And a block and a half from where we lived, once you crossed a little canal in the railroad tracks, you went into the swamps. I mean, we were way back there. In fact, as children, we used to play in the swamps, and there were canals and so forth and so on. But the point is that in the area I lived in, many of the people who populated that area were from the countryside. My father originally was from Donaldsonville, Louisiana. And at that time, during the 30s, 40s, Donaldsonville was one of the major spots in southern Louisiana for black people. We congregated there. My father walked from Donaldsonville New Orleans, which is about 80 miles or so, and he told us that story a number of times. My mother's people were from Violet, Louisiana. Violet, Louisiana is only about 20-25 miles south of where New Orleans is. So she came from the country. Her family came from the countryside. My father's family came from the countryside. And many people think of New Orleans just as an urban area. But the point I'm making is that the people I come from came from the countryside and some of whom even walked to New Orleans. So that famous Fat Domino song, Walking to New Orleans, I'm walking to New Orleans, that was not just a song, a playful song. That was a reflection of the reality of many of our people at that period.
Wow. So speaking of songs and art in that context, certainly being in New Orleans, I'm sure that also kind of contributed to, you know, the love, and I have to put it in that manner, the love that you have for Black music. And with that said, you being one who has been able to see and hear some of the, I guess, fundamental types of music coming from our people, is that something, those experiences, I mean, is that something that, of course, have, again, helped to shape who you are and what you do?
Yes, but not directly, not in ways that people may think about. One, my mother was the daughter of a Baptist minister, and she played piano in the church and taught Sunday school. She was responsible for me going to the junior high school I went to for 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. Before that, myself and my brothers went to whatever school she was teaching at. And she taught at a number of schools during my lifetime, four schools in particular. Two of them were way uptown, so a different area of the city altogether, Tommy LaFawn and Fisk Elementary School, which I attended because that's where she was. But when I got to sixth grade, she had moved on to Phyllis Wheatley. And then from Phyllis Wheatley, which I attended for a year or so, or 2 years, Phyllis Wheatley, there was a school that opened up about a block away from our house. And that school had been on a two-square block area that was an actual farm, you know, with horses, pigs, and chickens,
right,
and all like that. It was an actual farm. And the city bought it and converted it into an elementary school. Well, by that time, when that happened, I was too old to attend the school. So I never attended the school my mother taught at, which was you could stand in our front yard and see her room, which was on the end of the school. I never attended. But the school I went to was up in commonly known as the 7th Ward of New Orleans, and that was an area that was dominated by what some people would call the Creoles of color, Black Creoles.
Mm-hmm.
And this was my first time going to school where I'm on my own. I'm not going to school where my mother's teaching or anything, and I would catch the bus and go to school. At the time it happened, but I'm much more appreciative of now. And briefly, in 7th grade, I was enrolled in an industrial arts class. Mr. Conrad was the teacher. He had taken one of the industrial arts closets and turned it into a dark room. So in 7th grade, I was assigned to his class, and after school, he would teach photography. And that's how I became interested in, and photography was my first love.
Oh,
I used to work in the doctor and everything with Mr. Conrad. Then in 8th grade, my English teacher was Mrs. O.B. Nelson. And my social studies teacher was Mrs. Green. Mrs. Green taught social studies, history. And she, as I put it, and I'm being humorous, but I'm not being frivolous. She, while other school students in the 8th grade were listening to the Lambs and singing those things for the Easter parade and what have you.
Right.
She had us doing Black history pieces. So in eighth grade, I'm in Mrs. Green's class, and I'm assigned to play Crispus Attucks. And I jumped up behind the curtain. They had I had a sword fashioned out of a clothes hanger with a cardboard on it for a guard. And I jump out from behind the curtain, and my famous line was, "I am a desperate black man who's willing to fight for my freedom." Now, this is eighth grade. That was my social studies. My English teacher, Mrs. Nelson, in same grade, eighth grade, she said to us one day to the class, "Put your books away. I want you to hear something." I was glad to do that because I didn't like, you know, English studies and all like that. I put my books on the desk, and she pulls out a portable record player, puts a recording on, and it's Langston Hughes backed by a jazz band. And I remember to this day the last line of one of the poems that Langston Hughes recited that got me, and that was, "A poor man ain't got no business to die." It was a poem about a woman who had whose husband died suddenly, and she went around Harlem begging for money to be able to bury her husband. And so the line was, "A poor man ain't got no business to die." And when I heard that, I said, "That's it." Immediately after school, I went to the main branch of the public library, asked the librarian about Langston Hughes, where can I find his book? And she told me where to go, and I'm following the librarian's direction. I expect to see two or three books by Langston Hughes, the guy, you know, that Mrs. Nelson had introduced me to. And when I turned the corner and went to that shelf that I was directed to, it was almost two linear feet of books by Langston Hughes. Mm-hmm. Langston Hughes wrote books about everything. He had two autobiographies. He had numerous books like music about black people on Broadway and different things, you know. And he had short stories, and I was just amazed. I stood there and I said, "Oh, I guess this is what I got to do." And so, because I was Langston Hughes. And fortunately for me, I could not have had a better teacher. Langston, I read everything that I could find in that library by Langston Hughes. And he wrote so much. He wrote so many and so many different genres in fiction, in drama, writing plays and what have, in nonfiction, poetry. He did it all. So stupid me, I thought that's what it meant to be a writer. You're supposed to do it all. And that's how I got involved in it.
So, wow. So you went from your first love being photography and now being introduced to this world of literature, of writing. And of course, with that being Langston Hughes having that kind of impact. And so you mentioned something that I find really interesting, and that is, like, for example, today we talked a lot about B.A. Richards. And, of course, you know, once I mentioned to people, well, you all remember her because, you know, she was the one that played Sidney Poitier's mother in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And that's how people remember her, is through her work in, movies in on the screen, know of her work on stage. They don't know of her work as a poet. And so I find it's very interesting that it seemed like there was an era where, writers did a combination of things. They wrote poetry. They wrote music. They wrote, short stories, like you said. And so, you know, it seems like that was really, time period, that was really, you know, something that a lot of our writers did.
Well, I came up, as I said, I was born in 47. immediately after World War II and the Korean Korean conflict. And when I came up through the 50s, I had the opportunity to meet a lot of people. My parents got all three of their children, myself and my two brothers, involved in the NAACP. And we spent our after school and the weekends canvassing, passing out flyers, going door to door, encouraging people to register to vote. And at that time in Louisiana, in order to register to vote, you had to pass a test. And the test included a lot of questions about various things. But one question that invariably caused a lot of conflict and many people be unable to pass was, you had the day you went to register. If you went down to register on October 2nd, you had to figure out your birthday through the date. So to say that you're so many years, so many months, mm-hmm. and so many days old.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
And one day off, you were denied. Yeah, you were disqualified to register. So myself and my brothers, being the children of a school teacher and a laboratory technician, we had been they inculcated into us, you have to be twice as good to get half as far. And there's no question about it. My daddy had been a sergeant in World War II. And he didn't want any excuses. You had to do it. And my mother always used to tell us, no whining. I don't care what happens, no whining. You stand up and you do what you have to do. And she told me one time, she said, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but whatever you decide to do, be prepared to do it alone. Do not count on anybody else.
Wow.
So that was the kind of background we had, and we were reared into. So that's how I got involved. I became involved in the arts. My brother under me, Kieran, he became a businessman and had his own, was a place called Cafe Rose Nicole. In the American section of New Orleans. And he, 2 years ago, he retired from that. And right after he retired is when the COVID hit. And my youngest brother, my younger brother, Dr. Keith C. Ferdinand, he's a cardiologist. He's gone all around the world and as a cardiologist. So that was our family. We were raised in the movement. And we were almost, my father literally would kick your butt if you didn't do what you were supposed to do. And that was part of what you were supposed to do was every Saturday morning on our hands and knees, wax the hardwood floor. I mean, he didn't play. We had a garden in the backyard growing, you know, we grew vegetables in the backyard. It was that kind of. What can I say? It was that kind of country in the city rearing under a disciplinarian and a school teacher. It just made me who I am and made my brothers who they are today.
Yeah, so we kind of call it family structure. and definitely, folks that are a little bit older can relate to it because what we're seeing today is miles away from a lot of that. And we're going to talk a little more about that, too, in terms of what's going on today and why. But I want to go back for a moment and ask, so you were involved in the NAACP. Is that what kind of helped to now bring you into SNCC?
Well, I was never a formal member of SNCC because did not function in New Orleans, Louisiana. In fact, the civil rights organization, look, there are two things there. One, the civil rights organization that did the most work in New Orleans was CORE, Congress of Racial Equality.
Mm-hmm.
And Aretha Castle Haley, Aretha was the person who got me actively involved. In 11th grade, I was involved in sit-ins and what have you in New Orleans. I was arrested, and my parents, of course, supported us, but that was in 11th grade. Today, I live in a building called Ashe Development, Ashe Cultural Development Center, and Ashe is on an avenue that was recently, in the last 10 or 15 years, was renamed for Aretha Castle Haley. So the person whom we used to affectionately call Ming the Merciless, she was the main organizer and got me involved, and then the street was named after her, and I live on that street today. And it was just, that's just one of the confluences of life that I didn't plan to live here, and I certainly didn't plan for the famous Dry Street to be renamed Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard, but that's the way it is.
Wow. You know, it's so many thoughts coming into my brain right now, and I have so many questions, so I'm just going to kind of go dive into a few of them. Because I'm thinking about something, you know, me being a college student and really always issue I could get my hands on a black scholar and the black collegian. Every issue I could get, I would constantly, review them, go through them. And I remember, of course, in later years when Dr. Frances Kreswell, became really well-known in the black community. But I remember reading some of her articles in Black Scholar and other, really incredible magazines for that time period. And she would write these articles and essays and put them in those publications first. And, of course, we were involved with a few of those publications. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I became, let me put it as succinctly as possible. When I went to high school, the high school I went to, St. Augustine High School, I was sent to St. Augustine High School for the last 3 years of my schooling. I specifically say I was sent there. I didn't go there. I was sent there. My parents made me go there. And what was fortunate is that there was a very strong academic center there. Long story short, I got a scholarship to go to Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. A scholarship to go. It was cold up there. When I got there, I didn't like it. It was on a trimester system. At the end of two trimesters, I returned home. I quit. That was it for me as far as I was concerned with schooling. But the thing is, at that school, I became interested in cinema because they had a program showing films, and the films they showed were, for the most part, what would be called foreign films today. So there's a Polish director by the name of Andrzej Wajda. And Wajda's film, Canal, was about people who were Polish people who were resisting the Nazis. And they were forced to go into the sewer system. And they were trying to get away from the Nazis, stormtroopers, by fleeing in the sewer system. And that's why the film was called Canal, because it referred to the canals through Poland that eventually led out to the sea. I won't go much into that, but that's an example. Another example of a film, Roman Polanski's famous film at that time, Knife in the Water. I just saw a bunch of films, and I had an interest. So by the time I left the school and went back home, when I get home to New Orleans, my mother stayed on me about, she said, you just can't stop. You can't just, you're not going to sit around here and do nothing. You need to do something. And besides, this is 1965, besides, them people are going to come and get you. She didn't have to tell me who them people were. I had not signed up. I turned 18, but I had not signed up for the draft. 1965. So I hadn't signed up for the draft. So by her insistence, I finally went down to the draft board to register for the draft. When I went down there, this white woman at her desk asked me, how old are you? I said, I'm 18. When was your birthday? I told her my birthday. She said, and you're 18 now? I said, yes, yes, ma'am. She said, you're breaking the law. You come back here tomorrow at 12 o'clock or whatever time it was, and we're going to deal with you. I said, yes, ma'am. And I walked out, and I never went back. I went from that office to the recruiter's office, which was located on Canal Street, downtown New Orleans. And I went there and I told the recruiter, I said, I want to sign up for the Army, but I want to go anywhere except Vietnam. The man looked at me and laughed. I said, I'm serious. I'm willing to sign up, but I want to go anywhere other than Vietnam. He said, son, I can't promise you that. I said, I'm sure you all have jobs that they don't use in Vietnam. He said, yeah, but you have to pass a test for that. I said, give me the test. So they gave me the test. Long story short, I passed the test, and I end up at Fort Bliss, Texas, in El Paso, Texas, Fort Bliss in the desert. And I'm a Nike Hercules nuclear missile repair person. I'm trained to do the electronic maintenance of the Nike Hercules nuclear missile. And I had further training, biological, chemical, and radiological warfare. So I ended up going from Fort Bliss after the training was complete. They put me on a boat. And I end up in South Korea on a mountaintop about 50 miles from the DMZ. And I spent a year in South Korea and then came back, spent another year, my final year at Fort Bliss. But by then, I'm a sergeant, and I'm training people. And the training doesn't matter, but I was training people. And since I was a sergeant, I didn't have to do reveille. I didn't have to wake up early in the morning and stand there. I didn't have to do KP. I had a room of my own in the barracks. I didn't have to stand for inspections, all of that stuff. And I had a lot of free time. So I spent a lot of time doing two things. One, my interest in writing, reading and writing, and spent a lot of time at the library, and the other was my interest in the music. And I used to get off after the dinner time. I'd go straight to the USO club and check out a set of drums, and I would practice for about an hour because the rest of the soldiers, they had to, you know, stand for the evening call and all that kind of stuff. I didn't have to do all that. Right. And this was a training facility. So I had a lot of time to develop myself, and that's where I developed both my writing skills and my musical skills. When I get back home after I left the Army in 68. I got to New Orleans, and I'm going to phone what I've been doing. So when I get to New Orleans, I go out to the clubs and what have you, and I'm listening to the musicians, and I recognize I cannot outplay them cats. But I didn't find any writers whom I thought were better than I was, or so much better than I was as a writer. And so I ended up joining the Free Southern Theater. And that was my last practical experience being a musician. I mean, when I was in the Army, we had moved on and we had bands, we had a gig. In fact, when I left the Army, I had a gig in El Paso, Texas. And my bandmates say, man, don't go home. If you go home, you're not going to come back. We got this gig at this hotel, and we're going to be doing this, that, and the other. I say, you know I'm coming back because you know how much I love my drums. I'm going to leave my drums with y'all. You know I'm coming. I never saw those drums again. I never saw those drums again. But I joined the Free Southern Theater and became active in theater drama work. And from there, as they say, the rest is history.
Wow. So before we start talking more about what many are familiar with, the Black arts movement, which, of course, you know, was just perhaps one of the most exciting times since the Harlem Renaissance. I just want to ask this quick question because it came to mind. So the experiences that you just shared, did that kind of also lend to you writing about juju?
The magic of juju?
Yes.
Yes and no. Part of it is that when I got back home, I was not just with the Free Southern Theater. I was also an activist.
Right.
And as an activist, carrying on what I'd been, you know, taught to do by my parents and with the NAACP, got involved in a number of things, one of which was we did a sit-in to take over City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Ernest Morial was the first Black mayor, but during his time as the mayor, there were a number of police killings. And we thought it had gotten out of hand. So a number of us actually did a sit-in and we called it Blow the Whistle on Dutch. We had whistles, and when we went in there, they weren't doing no work while we were in there. We went in on a Thursday and didn't come out till Saturday afternoon, I think it was. And so I was very, very active. NAACP Youth Council, I had left that Youth Council before I went to college that year at Carleton College. So when I came back home, I was not at all interested in joining up with the NAACP or whatever. We became active in what you see today, a lot of activity by activists in the streets and what have you. That's mm-hmm. the kind of work we did. And we formed an organization called Ahidiana, which, just to give you a highlight, we ran a school from preschool to fourth grade. And we also organized a trip to People's Republic of China.
Mm.
And it was in Beijing. It was Peking at the time, where I first met Robert Williams, who was there in a hospital. And one of the interpreters asked me, did I want to meet Robert Williams? I said, of course. And they said, but you have to go by yourself because this was a special setup and everything. And what I understood later is that he was in the hospital in Beijing having an operation. Mm-hmm. And he was a special guest of the Chinese Communist Party,
yes,
which ran everything. And they were very, very strict about who would get to see Robert Williams and what have you. Long story short, we spent a wonderful time together while he was in the hospital. And mm-hmm. in later years, we, you know, we got to know each other when we came, when both of us returned to the United States. And I won't go into all of that right now, but I'm just saying right. that our organization was that kind of organization where we
wow.
did activities, ran a school, did international work and as well as national work. I won't go any further with.
Okay, just a quick question on that, though. Was this an independent school?
Yes, it was an independent school. We were part of a group called CB, the Council of Independent Black Institutions.
Yes, yes. Okay.
And CB was functioning all across the United States. And we had members from D.C. all the way to Palo Alto, California, different schools. It was a tremendous time period of social
yes.
struggle and activities. And part of that had to do with, as the Chinese said, the blessing is to be born during interesting times. Well, we came up during interesting times.
Wow.
And all times, I later understand all times are interesting, but not all times have activity. Organized yes. activity by the masses of people.
Yes, yes. And it's interesting that you're saying that because I keep kind of noting those time periods and have been saying that I think we're about to enter into one now, one of those designated time periods. I call it the Ma'atik Epoch. But, you know, again, you know, anyone can give it whatever title they want. But I see something coming where we're going to see some very similar things of people organizing and people doing things in our communities to a much greater extent than what they are now. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
My view on that is this. Again, I want to be very brief. Every major war, you find social activity. So when people talk about the Harlem Renaissance of the 20s, they neglect to mention that immediately followed what? World War One.
Yes.
And I call
yes.
it, I don't call it the Harlem Renaissance era, I call it the Garvey era.
Yes.
When Marcus Garvey was organizing, coming out of World War One. And then the Civil Rights Movement comes
yes.
right after what? Comes after
yes.
World War II and the Korean conflict. Those things, and all of the stuff we saw happening in the 60s was part of the anti-war movement. We don't necessarily call them that. The government does not want to call attention to the fact that every time there is military conflict of a major proportion, immediately following that, you find organization among the masses of people worldwide.
Very good analysis. Wow, I love it. Okay, well, moving right along. One of the questions that kind of, you know, comes into my mind, and of course I'm gonna, this is a sidebar, but I can't help but to ask and wonder, being in Louisiana, were you there during Katrina?
Yes. I've only lived in Louisiana, but I traveled around the world, and I was here. Katrina hit, we left, we drove from New Orleans to Houston, Texas, and then from Houston, we ended up in Nashville. When I say we, my wife and I ended up in Nashville. My children, I have five children, they were all over the place in different cities. One lives in today. One lives in San Diego. Well, let me go in order. My oldest daughter still lives in New Orleans. My oldest son lives in San Diego. Mm-hmm. My middle child, my daughter, lives in New York City. My youngest son lives in San Francisco. And my youngest daughter lives in Maryland, right out of East Ham. They are all doing extremely well, doing different things. So that when you asked me about Katrina, when Katrina mm-hmm. hit, the city was, as you saw on television, was devastated. It was flooded.
Yes.
And so I was in Houston and then from Houston to Nashville, but I didn't mm-hmm. stay in Nashville. Nashville mm-hmm. was like a landing spot, and I would travel all over the country. We went places like New Hampshire, mm-hmm. a place called Nebraska, somewhere in Omaha, Nebraska, I believe it was. And we went all over the country following Bob New Orleans, who had been put on buses and sent literally all over the country. And we would mm-hmm. follow them. At that time, when I was in New Orleans, I'd been working with an organization called Students at the Center. And we mm-hmm. taught, we had a creative writing and a AP English class that we were teaching, and I taught students, and some of my students would work with us during that period following Katrina, and I would tell them where I was going to be, and you know, we'll get a ticket for you and come on up, and because you can help with the teaching and explaining to people what's going on in New Orleans, but you also have been trained in the what we call the Students at the Center, so they knew the methodology, plus they had the ability to handle the equipment. I was teaching not just the AP English and the creative writing, but we also taught video, so they knew how to operate the cameras and what have you. It was mm-hmm. a tremendous time, and we went all over the country following Katrina, so that set us up. And in many ways, and it's difficult for people to understand it, but what happened with Katrina was a disaster. But what mm-hmm. happened with Hurricane Ida, it was an unseen disaster.
Mm.
Because what happened in New Orleans, they lost electricity for 10 days almost without mm-hmm. electricity. And it's one thing to have a water event, and it's another thing to be without power.
Mm-hmm.
And for a major metropolitan area to be without power for more than a week is an utter disaster.
Mm.
It affects you in ways that you cannot even begin to think about. And the thing about it, the sun is still shining, the streets are dry, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. so forth and so on, but there's no power.
Right.
So to get gas, we had to drive, we were going to Mississippi and what have you, trying to get gas. With gas cans and driving and coming back and so forth and so on. I don't want to bore you all with all of these details, but it's that to me is part of the future of the United States,
yes.
which many people don't see coming, but it is real that there are going to be time periods when metropolitan areas will not be able to sustain themselves, particularly for the lack of power.
I think that what we've just seen in this past year, people might not want to see or understand some things, but I think some things have been kind of made pretty clear that there are some things that are going to come. We've kind of seen some indication of that. Anytime you were in a situation, or we were in a situation where stores were closed, then when they did open, you were limited in purchasing certain items. We just saw right before our eyes things that I think most, never thought we would see. And so surely if that could happen, and it did, to the degree that it did, where everything got shut down, and not just in one city, not just in one state, but all over the country. I think, there's some clear indicators there. And again, I think there are a lot of our people see this and know it, but again, at the same time, don't want to see it.
Well, part of the reason they don't want to see it, and part of the reason some people don't see it, is because it's not a result of armed conflict. This is a result of what is popularly called climate change. And many people don't want to accept that climate change has affected the United States as much as it has. When Katrina hit New Orleans, the devastation was the result of a breach in the levees. That is, one of the levees failed and the water was able to rush in. When Ida hit New Orleans, there was no breach. The levees held. There was no water damage. But the direct result of climate change, and that hurricane ended up hitting Louisiana, lower Louisiana, New Orleans was the major city affected, and then ends up having flooding in New Jersey and New York, that same hurricane. People need to open their eyes and see. Climate change is affecting the United States in ways that people have not seen before. And it's only getting worse.
Right. It seems that a lot of things are getting worse, and not just in terms of the climate change, but also the attacks on our communities. To me, that is also getting worse, because whereas before it was, pretty blatant or right in our faces, now it's a lot more sophisticated. Now it's a lot more diabolical, as far as I'm concerned. What are your thoughts about what we're seeing today that's happening in Black communities nationwide?
Well, I would not limit it to nationwide. If we think it's just the United States, then we
I'm not saying that.
I understand what you're saying.
Right.
But my point is this. What we're dealing with today is a global phenomenon. That is something that affects the whole world. And we're not going to solve it, and we're not going to be able to deal with it unless we have an international or global analysis of what's going on and global solutions. Country, one hemisphere will not solve the problems. And it's going to take us learning a lot more. That's why the COVID, what's going on now with the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, COVID is a global phenomenon. Even though we usually talk about it in terms of the United States, but this is happening all over the world. And so I think this is what we have to deal with. I was blessed because I came up during a time period and in New Orleans where there was a big emphasis on local development. But then as I matured, as I grew up, I was sent away to school. I was in the Army. I went around the world and so forth and so on. So now, as an adult, as a young adult, I traveled to Africa. I traveled throughout the Caribbean, traveled to South America and what have you. And so I saw the world. I didn't just see what was going on where I was living. I saw the world, and I think that's part of what enables me to say what we're dealing with is a global phenomenon, and I can give you example after example, and I'll just simply say, if you look at COVID, put it with climate change, you know, you've got a cocktail that's not going anywhere anytime soon, and that affects all the people in the world.
Yeah, I definitely agree that we're looking at some serious global kinds of things that are affecting us all. But I also think that it's very, very important that we deal with the things that are right within our midst as well. You know, I come from a school where we say, you know how to walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. And so what that means is by, yes, we have to be internationally connected, concerned, and proactive. But what's happening now is that I've noticed that there are many who focus on international things from that perspective, but yet right there in your own community, ain't nothing happening. There's no real effort or, you know, and I'm seeing it so much. I'm seeing the focus on Afghanistan or Palestine or other places, but then what's going on right within our communities, and I dare say the increase of sex trafficking and kidnapping in our communities, those kinds of things are not being addressed. And so while I definitely agree, we must, again, and I say simultaneously, you know, look at this global situation. But unfortunately, you know, a lot are selecting or choosing to do more in areas where they have no direct connection to.
Well, that's part of the reason for that, I think, is a lack of leadership. We don't have a conscious leadership who are working on behalf of the Black community. See, during the period segregation, we had no choice. No matter what your education was about, no matter who your friends were, who you're married to, it didn't matter. Jim Crow, if you're Black, get back. You don't have that today. So we don't have a leadership that is forced to focus on what's happening with our people. And you can look at the reality today. And what do you see among our so-called leaders? You know, I'll leave it at that.
Absolutely. Oh, no. I mean, this is something that we've talked about quite often here in New Day. And in doing so, you know, look at what it is we at least must try to do, attempt to do to address it. Because if we don't, the situation is going to get worse, needless to say.
I think the solution, in my opinion, is a phrase that I didn't make it up, but it's a phrase that I use often, and that is to think globally, act locally.
Yeah.
Amilcar Cabral, who was the leader of the PAIGC in Guinea, and Cape Verde in West Africa, Amilcar Cabral used to say, and we taught Amilcar Cabral when I was working in the schools here in New Orleans with students at the center. Mm-hmm. Cabral taught us. He said,
yes,
start under your feet.
Yes, yes.
You can think whatever you want to think, but where you have to work is with the earth that is under your feet.
Mm, I like that. Yes.
You know, so the thinking is necessary, but the working, but it's not sufficient. The working is essential. You see, thinking is necessary, but it's not sufficient. Working is essential.
Wow. And I get it. I definitely get it. And I'm sure our family gets it too, because that's really what we're striving to do. It's to become more holistic, and that's terminology and focus that we now have to be able to, again, you know, piece these things together and connect them. And again, you know, take care of the situation that's right in your midst, as well as be able to lend in whatever ways you can in another circle or part of our reality. And I think, you know, that's what more I'm hearing, at least within the people that I'm connected to, that's kind of what I'm hearing them say and talk about. Wow, I have so many questions. And what I'm going to do before I ask any more questions, I'm going to ask our family that's listening and tuning in if they have any questions or comments that they may have. And if so, family, you can press one now, and certainly we would love to hear from you. We are talking again with our brother, Kalamu Yasalam, and this is a wonderful conversation. One of many I'm hoping for and looking forward to. And again, we're having these conversations not just for the sake of dialogue, but to do assessment, to do further evaluation, and certainly in that to come up with some possible solutions. Okay, we're not just going to talk. We're going to talk, evaluate, review, examine, but also think in the context of what can we do. What can we just try to do? It's not saying it's going to work or it's whatever, but what efforts must we put in place today? Okay, it doesn't look like anybody have any questions or comments, so that's okay because I got a whole bunch of them. So, and as I was, you know, I thought you were getting ready to say something. When I was going through, I was doing some research, actually, because, you know, we're doing the Recharge Genocide 21 campaign right now. And I just so happened to go to a page, and I saw one of your postings. And I've been meaning to contact you for a while, but when I saw the posting, I said, oh, yeah, I got to do it now. And the posting I saw was talking about Black women who were lynched. Do you remember that posting? It was a couple of years ago.
Yes.
What inspired you to do that particular posting? Because it was pretty in depth and it was definitely powerful. But what inspired you to do that?
Oh, I have a long-standing interest in what is called feminism, which grew out of my upbringing. Called what is that called? Well, Our Women Keep Our Skies from Falling.
Yes.
And
yes.
When it was based partly on the Chinese saying that came from the Chinese culture and the Communist Party of China, that women hold up half the sky. We had been to China,
yes,
and what have you.
Yes.
And so we said, our women keep our skies from falling, mm-hmm. recognizing the reality in the Black community is such that the main, if you look at our social conditions, in fact, I wrote a piece not too long ago in which I say, that when you start talking about the American way of looking at culture and family life, mm-hmm. you know, the man in a house is supposed to be in charge of this, you know, and so forth
right.
and so on. It's so patriarchal.
Right. That's right.
And said, in the black community, the man is a woman.
Oh, my goodness. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, if you look at our social conditions and the heads of many of our households are women, and they function objectively as, from an American perspective,
right.
as man of the household.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, we know this. We don't. It, once you break it down to people, they say, yeah, well, I guess you're right about that.
Wow.
I don't have to go any farther that, with it. I mean, you see it.
Yeah, that kind of speaks for itself, and that's a heavy, heavy thought. I mean, that requires a lot more than just hearing it. Wow. Okay. Well, you know, one thing I just want to, a little sidebar, and I heard you say feminism. And, you know, over the years, I've been kind of fortunate to talk with black women who are really moving in more of a realm of, you know, defining ourselves for ourselves. Some
mm-hmm.
call it kujichagulinga, self-examination. And so some of us are really now moving more in that direction, understanding that as time goes by, it's time to change the name of things or to upgrade it or what have you. And so, as you said, this terminology of feminism, you know, for some of us, it's not really appropriate or adequate in this day and age. I'm sure you're familiar with some of the works of Dr. Cleona Weems, who, you know, of course, have coined the phrase African womanism. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've been able to kind of look at that and say, oh, yeah, you know, this really helps to give better definition or indication or clarity about who we are as black women, as women of African descent, very distinctively. Because, you know, when you say feminism, you can, I mean, that can relate to anything. I mean, a cat could be feminine. Okay, so that ain't getting it for us. So in this day and age, in the 21st century, we're really learning what we're striving to define ourselves as black women in a way that we feel is just a bit more coming from us and not from somebody else. So one of the other phrases or terms that we're kind of, you know, tossing around or utilizing is original womanism, original woman. Because, again, as far as this point in time, the first woman is definitely a black woman. So this helps to bring about a clear distinction that certainly needs to happen in this day and age, given the fact that black women, even though there's been a lot of accomplishments as education and other kinds of things, there's still some areas that is not being addressed and certainly needs to, that's relevant to these 400 plus years, see. And so to address that kind of situation, we have to now make sure that we are also creating the kind of dynamics that will allow us to have a better handle on some of those things and not use other people's ideas, concepts, or other applications to address our issues. So what are your thoughts about some of that?
My thoughts are that we are all victims of, in the United States in particular, we are victims of the language that we have been forced to use. These are not our language that our mother tongue. In fact, I call it the other tongue, father tongue.
We
speak the father tongue. The patriarchy insisted that we use English. But when
Absolutely.
We use the English, we often do it in our own ways.
That's right.
And because we do it in our own ways, what we find now is that the linguistically, the United States is black. I have a poem, The Air is Black. Because you can't, when you think of American culture, what you're going to end up thinking about is something that was a contribution that black people did. Thought is a seed. But if you look at a seed, unless you have vision, you cannot see a tree. And then even if you can see a tree in a seed, the seed is not a tree. The seed has to go through various stages to become a tree.
Yes.
So let us not be overly concerned about seeds. We recognize that a seed is necessary. The seeds are necessary, but they're not sufficient, and we must deal with the trees. We
Absolutely.
Are in the woods. We are in the
Absolutely.
Woods. So we better understand trees and not just focus on seeds.
You know, and I certainly agree. In fact, when I hear that, I think about people that I've had the opportunity to meet and watch and be around and to really kind of learn from. For example, Mumia Abu-Jamal. What helped me to understand, overstand, as some say, how important it is to know that, yes, we're locked into this language, but that for some and maybe more in the future, we have to learn to speak through the language, which is for me what Mumia had just such an incredible talent and capability of doing. Mumia could read something, and then someone else could read the very same thing. But what you would hear from him oftentimes would be something very different. It would be the same information. It would be the same, you know, content. But you heard something else as well. His voice, his tone, his able capability, and you as a writer, of course, know what I'm talking about. My point is that even though, yes, you know, we have to talk in this language, there's some things that, for whatever reason, is not being translated to the degree where it really benefits us to the degree of necessity. And for me, that feminism thing is one, I cringe when I hear it. And again, and there's a few other terms, you know, from eras that were popular at that time, and certainly so, because you didn't have anything else. But everything changes at some point, and I dare say we better in some areas, particularly when it comes to defining who we are. And so, again, I totally agree, my brother, that we can't be caught up in, you know, the things that is just nonsense or, you know, not even worth the time or the effort. But some things have a big impact on us. And as a black woman, I certainly will say some things that I was taught and it's being taught, you know, I have to pay really close attention to it now. Because some things that I was taught as a young girl was really like, you know, now in understanding it, I wish somebody had told me something else, you see, because I understand, you know, from whence it came. And that didn't change. That was given that way, and it came that way, you see. And so now I'm I put forth a lot of effort that when I'm conveying certain types of information, I try to the best of my ability to put that extra little spin on it to help identify or give it an earmarking, you see. And so that's what I was referring to in saying that, yes, absolutely, we're caught in this maze
of language that is not ours, but at the same time, we've always managed to create within this language our own language. And that own language becomes very distinct in certain instances, just like, you know, with music, for example, or in the hood, for example. We use certain, you know, slang words, as they call it, to identify certain things. So again, when you're talking about describing things and helping people to get involved in things, for whatever reason, we've kind of just taken it as it is, you know. And I think at this stage of the game, we've got to really be a little more cognizant of that and work towards really tapping into some of the essences of who we are as a people, and I dare say as Black women, to go deeper, much deeper than what we've been told, because some of it has been sugar-coated. And I'm talking about a white sugar. Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying. I have a view that is partially based on, as I said earlier, having traveled virtually around the world.
Yeah.
And once you've gone around the world and interacted with people around the world and seen what has happened around the world, I can't just be concerned about my local condition. And at the same time, that if I'm not doing anything locally, I'm not doing anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we have to have, as I said, think globally, act locally. It's very important, wherever we are, that we have some form of activity wherever we are located. That's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
mm-hmm.
also important that we think on a global basis,
absolutely.
That we do not limit our thinking just to what we see in front of us. If
mm-hmm.
we only work based on what we see, then we will never understand the world, because the world is larger than what we see.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say that again.
I definitely agree. I definitely agree. I'm just concerned.
Our concern, I understand the concerns, and I think our concerns are legitimate concerns. And the way to deal with it is to act in a local manner, wherever
mm-hmm.
you are located.
Mm-hmm.
Act in a way that is consistent with the liberation of your locale.
Absolutely.
Wherever it may be. So you could be in Germany. You could be, you know, in the Caribbean. You could be in South Africa. You could be in India. Wherever you're located, you know, whomever you are as a human being, you can do the work. You can do the work of that period. And I think, this may be controversial to some people, but I think the reason, in particular in the United States, so many of us are obsessed with white people is because we live in a white supremacist environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we are so constantly up under the gun of white supremacy that we think we give a color to oppression.
Yes.
And we give a color to our freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Our freedom is not based on a color. I mean, we will not get free just simply fighting white people.
Mm-hmm.
We have to deal with the whole world, which includes ourselves. People are a problem, but they're not our only problem.
Right.
And on top of that, not all white people are white.
Right. Yeah, and that's really what I was saying earlier as well, meaning we got to deal with some of our own stuff. And that's really what I was referring to, is that there is this, you know, external thing, or, and I'm talking about even in terms of dealing with other countries or other nations, you know. I haven't traveled the world yet, but I definitely have, you know, gone to other countries and have interacted. In fact, as soon as this pandemic thing, you know, subsides a bit more, I'm getting back out of here. But the thing that I've realized is that I've met a lot of people, our people, who are well-learned or well, they travel a lot. But again, in our communities, right? For example, you mentioned CB earlier. We talked about independent school. Well, where they at now? We have more people who have degrees or other kinds of skills. Where are they at now? Where are the schools and cultural centers that are independent in our communities now? So, again, yes, we definitely have to see the world. We definitely have to interact. But unfortunately, what is very obvious is that that's not being transferred or transformed or being used to transform many of our own communities. And that's what I'm really more concerned, you know, when I say I'm concerned, because I'm seeing it, because it is right in our faces that people can tell you all about this other stuff. And I'm talking about our people. And again, it's, and when I say our people, don't get me wrong, I interact with a lot of different things, groups of people, issues, and so forth. I've been interacting for the last 5 years in different things at the United Nations. And so my point is that, yeah, you know, that's one of the hats that we wear. But at the same time, it's just like with any profession or any discipline, you have to deal with an area of specialty, you see. And so even though you have to do all these other things, if you're a doctor, you have to study all these other areas before you, you know, really get into the field that you really are applying yourself to. You have to know about those other areas, and some of them you have to be well-versed in them. But then at some point you specialize in an area. And this is what, you know, I'm saying as a people, we have to begin to look at the fact that there are some very unique that have really only happened to us in this land. Just as indigenous peoples, there are some things that only happen to them, and they deal with it accordingly. And my point is that I don't believe, or I'm not seeing us deal with what has happened to black people, African people in this country, to the degree that it should and that we're capable of. And somebody has to say that and act on it, by the way.
I hear you.
So before we close out, again, are there some projects or anything that you're working on presently?
Working on a number of things. The main project, long-term project I'm working on, is a project called Seeing Black, Photography in New Orleans, 1840 and beyond. Photography was founded in France in 1839.
Mm-hmm.
There was a man by the name of Jules Leon, or Lion, if you want to anglicize his name. But Jules Leon was born in France, was a resident of New Orleans. He lived in New Orleans, and he would go back and forth between New Orleans and France. He happened to be in France in 1839 when photography was developed. And he got back home to New Orleans, which is his established domicile. When he got home to New Orleans in 1840, he organized an exhibition of photography.
Oh, wow.
That was only the second exhibition of photography that ever happened in the United States. The first was about 3 or 4 months earlier in New York City. From 1839, when Jules Leon returned to New Orleans, 1840 when he returned to New Orleans, excuse me. From 1840, New Orleans has been a center of photography for black photographers, but the city is not known for that.
Right.
One of the reasons it's not known for that is because much of the photography was based in the black community.
Wow.
We did it ourselves, for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the early black photographers nationally are unknown to many people. But in any case, the project I'm working on, Seeing Black, is specifically to, from 1840 and beyond, to talk about the black photographers who worked in and came from the city of New Orleans. So that one example, AP was the last, AP Badu was the last major photographer to Washington for about 3 or 4 years as an official photographer for Booker T. Washington. Badu was from New Orleans. He had his assignment and was working with Booker T. Washington. He has a photo of George Washington Carver as a middle-aged man. That is incredible.
Wow.
Most people only know if they have seen a picture. Anyway, that's the project I'm working on. Seeing Back, Photography in New Orleans, 1840 and beyond.
Wow.
And that's one of the projects I'm working on right now.
Wow. Oh, I like that. I mean, again, anything that, further documents and archives our stuff, it's just so necessary. And to have that being done by black folks, I think, again, it's just, so necessary in this day and age. Well, my brother, I thank you so very much for taking the time to talk with us and share with us. And I'm definitely looking forward to having more conversations. We're in the process now, of course, of creating, publications and journals and other things so that black women are able to further some of the great work that has already been given to us. And I definitely would like to, as that happens, share some of that with you, get your views on it and so forth. It's kind of in the year coming, but we're definitely working on it and getting it ready. So, again, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us, to share with us. And, I look forward to getting you back with us soon.
Okay. Looking forward.
All right, my brother. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
All right, family. We are getting ready to close this session out. And, again, that was a wonderful dialogue and conversation. I certainly enjoyed it, and I'm hoping that you all did as well. There was a lot that I think we covered in a very short period of time considering, and definitely there's much, much more that we need to look closer at, particularly, again, we're in a time period where if we don't begin to make some additional kinds of steps forward, as the brother mentioned, there's some things coming down the pipe, and will we be ready? Well, I can tell you some of us will, because we are going to continue to fight and definitely uphold the spirit of resistance. With that said, family, again, we want to thank all of you for tuning into this session of New Day. We're still on the road heading back to Philly from D.C., and we will be continuing with our next steps of bringing forward the Mean Woman March 24, which will be getting ready for the big 25. And boy, wait till you see what we've got. And you know what? I'm looking so forward to the haters because, they've raised their heads over the years. And so
I certainly anticipate them doing so as we proceed with the 25. But again, I think it's going to be really, really interesting to say. So, at any rate, family, we thank you all again, and we will be back next week, same time. I want to remind you again, this week we will be doing a tribute to Ken Bridges as we proceed with the Reparatory Justice virtual conference. We're also going to do a tribute to the great Paul Washington, both brothers from Philly, both made tremendous contributions to the world, okay, not just to Philly, and not just to the nation, but to the world. And so we're going to also get ready to commemorate on October the 16th, Black Men Nationwide. We're going to call that Black Man's Appreciation Day. And again, hail up our brothers who are in our communities nationwide doing the work and doing the things that we know should be done in this day and age to help bring us forward. We want to salute them, and we're going to give a roll call on October 16th. So, sisters, if you want the name read off or provided in the honor roll call, then feel free to send us that to us at nationalmwm@aol.com. Again, nationalmwm@aol.com, and I'll certainly respond to you. All right, family, again, we thank all of you for tuning in. I want to remind you, of course, Brother Lee Robinson is on every Sunday with Africa Move. Of course, Sister Keisha, Brother Ashe are on Thursdays at 8 o'clock with Thorough Black Talk. Africa on the Move, of course, comes on at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and that is, of course, on Blog Talk Radio as well. And we have some new things coming your way for this month of October, so get ready, stay in tune and in touch. And until the next time, we remind you that there can never be any real peace, meaning Hotep, until it's truly what we call, there's no justice, there will certainly be no real peace. Until next time, we say, come on to the center. Together, we shall win.